I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911,
what's your emergency? I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying. I think a rescue is needed. 3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
Christina,
no. He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions, a co-production of WGLT Radio and Reader Reporting. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We've been investigating the mysterious death of 3-year-old Christina McNeil, who was found not breathing by her father in their Bloomington, Illinois apartment on June 16, 1998. Barton McNeil was convicted in connection with his daughter's death, though he has alleged since the day after the incident it was his girlfriend, Masuk Nolan, who was responsible for Christina's death. Years later, Masuk was convicted herself of murdering her mother-in-law. Today, during Suspect Conviction, Scott, we hear from a professor and true crime buff.
Yes, we have a very distinguished professor. Her name is Amanda Vickery. She teaches psychology at Illinois Wesleyan University, right here in Bloomington, Illinois, where the murder took place. And not only that, Amanda is a diehard true crime buff, but she appeared on a true crime show this past week, Married with Secrets.
He did engage the victim in conversation about him watching her.
He knew she had a roommate, and he had been planning to do the same thing to her. This is a very dangerous man who may strike again.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about this, Amanda?
It was pretty exciting, given that, you know, I watch these shows for fun, and then to be on one was just sort of out of this world. So they did a show on our very own local Bloomington cop / serial rapist, Jeff Pilo. So he was a Bloomington police officer who was convicted of assaulting several women. It's a pretty crazy story. And so they came and filmed around Bloomington, and I was their local crime expert.
We can talk a little bit about the show. Some of the sexual assault survivors appeared on the show and talked about it. There was once a time when we didn't talk about those things, and it was there was a culture silence around this. Has things changed a little bit?
I think so, and that was something that I've heard other people and experts mention about this case, actually, that the survivors were really outspoken and willing to come forward, and they wanted to testify. And I've seen other clips of them that weren't shown on this particular program where they're there at the courthouse and they're angry and they, you know, just want him to go to jail. And so one of them said one time in a program, I remember hearing something like, you know, he picked the wrong women. And he really did, because they were not hesitant about going after him and being forthcoming about what he did. It was really impressive.
You know, I'm a survivor.
Yes, I saw that online recently.
Well, I write a newspaper column. It's been, of course, as our listeners probably know, I mean, I've been a newspaper reporter and editor for almost 30 years, and I wrote a column about being attacked when I was 12 years old by a man. It was a very difficult column to write about. And
is that something that you have never written about before?
No. In fact, it's something I really have never really talked about outside of a few very intimate settings, like with a counselor at one time and with my wife. I mean, I've been such a deep, dark secret. When I got attacked, it was actually, I grew up on a farm and I was baling hay, and a man grabbed me and threw me on the ground and started kissing me and groping me.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I broke away and ran, and I told my mother, and her response was, take a shower and we'll never speak of this again.
Mm-hmm.
And 40 years have passed, but I know the scars that are there. I mean, you know, like 10 years later, I would wake up in my college dorm room just terrified because I was reliving this in a dream. And I think a lot of people don't understand when you're the victim of a crime like this, it stays with you a long, long time. I thought it was really cool that these women felt empowered to come forward and talk about what happened to them. And I think it's, you know, one of the things that's, as a journalist, I think is really important is for a long time, there's so much shame surrounding being a survivor. And there's nothing to really be ashamed of. You didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
But for some reason, newspapers and other places have treated it like it's something shameful. I think it's really encouraging now that women feel, and some men, you know, obviously, feel comfortable stepping forward and talking about what happened to them.
And saying, go ahead and insert my name. You know, I have nothing to be ashamed of. I don't need to be anonymous.
Exactly. So let's talk about the Masuk and Barton McNeil and Christina McNeil in this case. I'm told you're one of our avid listeners, so give me your impressions of the case so far.
It's a complicated one. On the surface, if you look at this case, when I was trying to tell some of my family members over Christmas that I was, you know, going to be talking to you about it, I'm trying to explain it to them, and they're just like, what? I can't even follow this. So you have this woman who brutally murders her mother-in-law, likely strangles her to death, we think, and, you know, hangs out with her body for a while until she has someone from church unknowingly help her move and bury it. And then you find out that 10 years or so ago before that, a man goes into his daughter's room and finds her dead and tries to tell the police that his crazy ex-girlfriend did it. And no one believes him and he's in jail. And then you find out that the crazy ex-girlfriend is the woman who went on to murder her mother-in-law. I mean, it's like one of those made-for-TV movies that you think can't really be based on true events or they're exaggerating something, but this really is what happened. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
There's people out there who seem on the surface very normal, and then you find out there's these deep, dark secrets out there, and it's like, ooh, wow. I did a story on death row. When there was a death row here in Illinois, I went up to Pontiac Penitentiary, and I was interviewing a death row inmate, and I'm in the death row visiting room, and I'm looking around at the other inmates, and it's like, these guys look so ordinary.
Oh, yeah.
It's the banality of it. I mean, they could be the customers at the diner I have breakfast at every morning. I mean, there's no horns growing out of the back of their head, but all of them had committed horrible, horrible murders. Murders so violent and so depraved that a jury decided to put him on death row.
She was married a couple times, right?
Yeah, she's
had a couple kids.
Yeah.
Apparently, there were people out there who thought that she was pretty normal. And then for this to be a woman is highly unusual. I mean, there certainly are women killers out there, but I feel like most of the time it's maybe a one-time situation. You know, they kill their husband or something like that. Whereas in this case, well, she's only been convicted of one murder, but, you know, suspected perhaps, and at least one other. And so that makes it even more unusual.
You specialize in something called attachment theory. I would like you to explain that to us and give us your impression on how this might have affected Masuk.
Well, the basic idea of attachment theory is that your interaction at a very young age, basically from birth, the first couple of years of your life, can really set the stage for how you interact with not only, you know, your parents, but other people throughout the rest of your life. So, for example, if you grew up with a mother who was caring, who was attentive to your needs, who came to you quickly when you were crying as a child, you sort of develop this secure attachment orientation, this idea that you're going to be able to trust and rely upon others, that other people are trustworthy, and people tend to have then more secure, satisfying romantic relationships as adults, better relationships with their parents, their friends, their children, whereas people who grow up with caregivers, usually the mother, who is more avoidant, who is involved, who doesn't speak to the child's needs, or who's more inconsistent, maybe the person, you know, is on drugs or alcohol or something like that, then the child has a greater tendency to grow up being more anxious or avoidant themselves, not trusting others, perhaps seeking out more dysfunctional relationships. And this isn't a 100% guarantee. It's not as if you grow up in a rough household that you're guaranteed to, you know, struggle with attachment throughout the rest of your life. But there have been studies that have followed many people for many years and found that there does seem to be a strong link between how you're treated those first couple years of life and how you end up as an adult relating to others. We don't know a lot about this book. Early life, right?
Well, we know that her mom died at a very young age, when Masook is very young. We know that, at least the story that she's told her, one of her children, was that she was abused by her father. But we don't know a lot about that. We know that she wasn't from the lowest economic strata of South Korea, but she grew up in fairly modest circumstances. So those are the things we kind of have gathered about her. And we also know that she's been married, three times, and then she had this relationship with Bart that stretched over 3 years, and there were some other relationships out there as well.
You mentioned before from her relationship with Bart that there's actual police reports of her being abusive towards him, right?
Yes, there are. I mean, in fact, she was found guilty of something related to domestic abuse. Which is fairly unusual for a woman when it's directed at an adult man. What do you gather from that, you know, using that psychology background of yours? Mm-hmm. I mean, what are your thoughts?
One thing we know is that people who are abused, women included, are more likely to then be abusers. It may very well be the case that she was abused in childhood. She probably had a rough upbringing. Her mother died at a young age. I mean, that alone can certainly affect people and how they relate to others. And if she had a rough relationship with her father, then that may very well be part of the cause, not all, but part of why she has gone through, you know, 3 marriages and, you know, seems to be having some difficulty relating to others in her life. I don't think that we can really blame that for her committing a murder, of course, but in terms of her attachment to others, maybe being involved in dysfunctional relationships, maybe being part of the cause of that dysfunction, I think we can probably look back at her childhood and attribute some of it to that.
You're tuned to Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern along with Scott Reeder, and we're joined by Illinois Wesleyan social psychologist Amanda Vickery, who is with us via cell phone today during Suspect Convictions. Scott, one of the things that we've received here at Suspect Convictions over the last few weeks, and some of this was a little bit because of the holidays, but we actually did receive a reach out from Masook. You have been trying to get a hold of her during much of our time on the air here, trying to get a response from her regarding the Christina McNeil death. She did write you, so why don't you share that with our listeners at this time?
Well, here's the letter. Dear Mr. Reeder, I received your request for an interview. However, due to my own ongoing legal proceedings, I am unable to consent to any detailed media interviews at this time. With regard to Mr. McNeil's allegation of my involvement in the crime for which he was convicted, I can state with confidence that I was thoroughly investigated and excluded based on a solid alibi verified by receipts and other records. This is obviously a desperate attempt by Mr. McNeil to gain release from prison by exploiting a tragic but unrelated situation. Please let me know if you need any other question. Thank you so much for your time. Sincerely, Masook Wang, and then in parentheses it says R89230.
Were you surprised to hear from her?
A little bit. I mean, I've written to her, I think, 3 times asking for an interview, wanting to give her point of view. I don't know if she's been listening to the podcast or not. Obviously, you don't have cell phones in prison, but you can have a radio, and WGLT also broadcasts this podcast, and ironically, the prison that Masuk is held in was within the coverage area of the radio station, so she could be listening to it. I don't know. But I think it's interesting that she did finally get back to us. When you listen to those words, what comes to your mind, Amanda?
She seems pretty firm in stating that she didn't do it. She's definitely pinning it on Bart, saying, you know, that this is an attempt by him to draw attention away. I guess it's not surprising that she can't really go into details about anything. Does she have appeals ongoing? Is that what she meant by her ongoing legal situation?
Yes, she has been handling her appeals on her own without legal assistance for quite a while now. And just this last month, she was assigned an attorney from the Bloomington Public Defender's Office. So she's just coming back into, you know, kind of the serious, you know, I'm going to appeal this sort of thing. The interesting thing is she's never denied killing the mother-in-law. She just, the circumstances of why she did it have been in dispute and some other things.
What did you think of her saying that she was thoroughly investigated and cleared and that she has receipts? What do you think of
good,
all that?
Well, good question, because I read this letter to Bart, and one of the first things he said is, okay, how does she know when the child was killed? What hour the child was killed at?
He said
she has an alibi, but an alibi for what time period?
Right.
He said Christina went to bed, I think it was around 8:30. He found the body at 7. He says that he knows that he heard Christina sitting up in her bed talking about, I think it was midnight or 12:30, somewhere around there. But his question is, okay, if Masuk says she has an alibi, for what period of time does she have the alibi? Does she have an alibi for 3 in the morning? I mean, woman lived by herself.
Right, who does have an alibi for 3 in the morning?
Exactly. So, I mean, I thought that was a really good point that he was making there. It's like, okay, how can you say this if you don't have any direct knowledge of when Christina died? So I thought that was a really good point that he was making there, and I don't have a really good answer for that. I mean,
do you think the police really took Bart's claim seriously of her as a suspect at the time?
Well, obviously they didn't, because they arrested him the day of the autopsy, the day after the murder. You know, he's presenting her as an alternate suspect, but they arrest him almost immediately. Like, what have they done to verify that this woman couldn't be the killer? And that really runs through my mind of, it'd be a pretty hard thing to reach a conclusion on within a matter of an hour or two after you've determined that the murder took place, because that's right after the autopsies they determined that a murder had taken place. Because you remember the day before they were very dismissive of Bart when he kept calling in and saying, I think my daughter was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, they had the autopsy result come back. Yeah, we believe she was smothered. And within just a few hours, they arrest Bart because he was home, quote, alone with Christina. Now, that raises the question of how thoroughly did they investigate the alternate suspect that Bart had been pointing to? I don't know how you can say that all the alibis were checked and verified and everything was taken care of before you pick who you're going to charge with this crime. I just find that really hard to believe. I mean, what are your thoughts, Amanda?
Yeah, it doesn't sound like they had time to really investigate a whole lot. At what point, do you know, did he first say, hey, you need to look into my girlfriend or ex-girlfriend? Because I know Aphrodite Jones was saying, you know, why didn't he jump to this conclusion right away? Because they'd had this huge fight that night. He said, well, I didn't realize it was a murder right away. But once he called back the police and said, you know, there's a fan in here, it looks like the window's been cut, at what point did he mention Masuk?
He started mentioning Masuk right after he saw that the screens had been cut, he said. And he became more and more insistent as the night went on that a murder had taken place. And, you know, in fairness to Bart, I mean, I'm told that Christina did have asthma. If you found your child dead in bed, would you immediately assume it was a murder?
No, and there were no signs of anything.
I mean, there was no obvious look at the body sort of thing, like, oh, yes, this child had had this. I mean, it took an autopsy to determine that a murder had taken place. I don't get too hung up on that. What the defense has said in a lot of wrongful conviction cases is what they call tunnel vision, where law enforcement focuses in on one person early on and then builds the case around them. And they arrested Bart like almost immediately after the autopsy results. And it's like they find out there was a murder, and then almost immediately arrest the dad that was home with the child without really, I don't know how they could have gotten to the point where they could have ruled out the girlfriend so early on. I mean, I would think.
Or even ruled out someone else.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not unheard of for someone to break into a random house with other people home. I mean, you have the Elizabeth Smart case, the Polly Fast case. I mean, and I'm sure there's many, many more. Obviously, it's rare and unusual, but there have been cases where people have broken into a home with other people present to assault someone or try to kidnap someone or whatever it may be. So even if it was not Masuk, it seems like they could have spent some time, you know, dusting for fingerprints, checking out sex offenders in the area. Maybe they did to some degree, but that could be a very real possibility as well.
Well, let me ask you this. Since you are now somebody who has been part of a case, you know, you were on the IG channel talking about the Jeff Pilo case. The Bloomington Police Department's not one without blemishes, is it?
The Jeff Pilo case was a tricky one because it definitely made the police department, of course, look bad that you have someone on the force who was actually using his connections with the police department to help him commit these crimes. He was using access to the computers and the databases to find these women, essentially. He would see them out somewhere and watch as they walk to their car, basically, and then look up their license plate to see where they lived and look up the license plates of other cars who were in their driveway to see maybe who they lived with or find out about their family. So that definitely was not a good mark for the Bloomington Police Department. But that said, my impression from everything is that once they started to suspect him, you know, they didn't try to cover it up at all. They didn't try to protect it, but they went full out and being completely open that this is the guy, this happened under our watch, and we're going to do everything we can now to put him in jail for as long as possible. So I felt like they came away from that case with still a decent reputation despite the fact that the rapist was a police officer.
We just ended our last episode on DNA and the touch DNA that was found in the case. What was your thoughts when you were listening to that episode?
I actually found it to be not that compelling because, like you said, the DNA, her DNA, Masuk, should be all over the apartment. I mean, her and Bart dated off and on for 3 years. And, you know, if you find the DNA of some random man that lives down the street, that's a little more interesting. Or if you had found maybe Masuk's blood on the sheet from where Christina had scratched her, or if you found something under Christina's fingernails. But something about the touch DNA on the sheet just didn't strike me as that compelling.
What do you personally think happened that night?
Obviously, I'm not sure. One thing I keep going back to is if Bart did it, what was his motive? So one thing that you might think at first is, well, he's a younger father. He's got this three-year-old daughter. Maybe she's a financial burden to him. Maybe he's tired of trying to, you know, arrange his dating life around taking care of her, and he wants her out of the picture. But by all accounts, I haven't seen anything that alludes to that at all. I don't think anyone testified to that. That didn't seem to be the case. So then you have maybe some sort of sexual abuse going on, which I know we have the experts going back and forth as to whether anything even occurred. If so, we don't know when, we don't know who, and so that all seems very questionable. If he was abusing her, why did he decide to kill her? Was he worried she was going to tell? Was her mom suspicious? I mean, there's really nothing pointing to any of that, and so there doesn't seem to be an obvious motive for Bart to have done it. And then one thing that you brought up a lot in one of the early episodes was the fact that Barnhart essentially, if he did do it, got away with it. You know, if he didn't do it, he was trying to make it look like natural causes. He didn't, you know, stab her. There were no signs of distress on her body. And so the police come, and or the ambulance comes, they take her away, everything's good to go. Why in the world would he then call later that day and say, oh, you might want to check, maybe she was murdered? I mean, that just seems stupid. He would have to have been thinking, hey, I got away with it, I'm good to go. And so if he did do it, that part just really doesn't make any sense. And so if you rule out Bart, you have maybe three other options. One, she died of natural causes. The remaining possibilities are a stranger that was just, I don't know, watching the apartment or coming by that night, which is possible but also unlikely. Or you have Masuk, who had a motive. You know, Bart had broken up with her that day. It was a very volatile relationship. And as far as we know, she has had the means. She says she has an alibi, but like you said, she couldn't have an alibi for the entire night. She knew where Christina was sleeping. She knew Bart's pattern. And so, and the biggest thing, of course, is that now we know that she's a murderer, that she has no problem killing people that she knows. In the case of her mother-in-law, it seems to be revenge to get back at her husband, which is very similar in this case, if that's what happens. You know, she killed Christina, and she did it to hurt Bart, to get revenge on Bart for breaking up with her, basically. And so when you look at all that, there's a possibility she died of natural causes. There's a possibility Bart did it. There's a possibility that a stranger did it. But knowing what we now know about her, it does seem to lean towards being more likely that she was responsible, especially given that she went on to murder someone else. I mean, there's not that many people out there who are capable or willing to murder someone. And when we know that she is, then that sort of causes you to look at everything in a whole different light.
Well, thank you, Amanda. I appreciate you taking your time for us.
Thanks to Amanda Vickery, social psychologist at Illinois Wesleyan University, a true crime buff, and part of the Independent Channel's recreation of the Bloomington, Illinois serial rapist case, for which Bloomington Police Sergeant Jeff Pilo is serving time in prison. That aired recently on the Independent Channel. She spoke to us via cell phone. Next week, Scott, during suspect convictions, we'll talk with those mainly responsible for reinterest in this case.
Interestingly enough, Willis, it's two of Bart's cousins. One is Chris, who lives in California, and one is Grace, who lives in Indiana. And together, they really reinvestigated the case themselves and then reached out to the Innocence Project and got them involved. It's a fascinating story about two cousins that really didn't know Bart particularly well before incarceration, but believed in his innocence and pursued it.
That's coming up next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.